Hello and welcome to the GAK.co.uk Guitar Shop Podcast. I am your host Mark Packham, who is with me this evening.
Hello, my name's Jay. I'm the assistant manager here in the guitar store.
Hello, my name's Matt and I'm the manager.
And I'm Joe and I'm here for all your bass related queries.
How's things going this evening, gentlemen? Have you had a good week? The gang is all back
together.
I know.
Yeah, how long's it been?
See, I was considerate with my holiday. I've had my holiday in between podcasts, so I've just got back just in time.
Right.
Some of us can't afford to be jaunting off to America for 4 weeks.
Yeah. I didn't go for 4 weeks. I went for 2.5.
But you missed.
You missed four podcasts?
No, I didn't miss four podcasts. No, Matt missed one last week.
Oh, yeah.
Then we're back and then we've got like a new area. Well, no, I think it's the same area last time. We've got a new table.
Yeah, well, you know. This is the first time you've podcasted on this table.
Yeah, we podcasted on this table last week.
When you couldn't be bothered to turn up.
I don't know what I was doing. I was on holiday, yeah.
Do you want to talk into your microphone?
Yeah, hold on. Let me shimmy it around this way slightly. That's better.
Good, that's what we like. So last week, we talked about the evolution of the electric guitar, I guess, from the 50s to the 60s. We said we were going to do right up to the 90s, but we just ran out of time. There's too much to talk about. So I thought we'd carry that on this week. We'll do 70s, 80s and 90s. Plenty of stuff to talk about, from kind of classic rock right through to Britpop, I guess, by way of digital rap gear and hair metal. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of other guitar around in the 80s. I think it was a bit of a...
Well,
don't jump ahead.
I was just, you know, building up, giving you guys something to think about.
Okay. Well, let's go way back. Let's talk about the 70s. Now, the first... I haven't written down anything particularly here, but what I wanted to say was Les Paul, reintroduced in 1968 after years away. Gibson discontinued in, what, 61?
60... Well, yes. 60 was the last year, so yeah, I think 61.
And then replaced with the SG under the Les Paul name until 63, I think.
Yeah, and then it was just SG, because I think he sued them or something. I can't remember, was it he sued them?
I just think he didn't get on with the SG shape.
I didn't think he'd sued them, I just thought he didn't. Yeah, he didn't want to be affiliated.
Right, okay.
And then in that kind of interim, I guess, mid to late 60s, people started picking them up. I was reading a thing about Keith Richards playing one, and that being like the first time a kind of star had played one since Les Paul. So after Les Paul dropped out in the kind of...
Wait, what year was that?
Like 65, 66.
That seems so crazy.
They went like 3 years, 3-4 years being just
not popular.
Well,
they all
popular.
Played 59s, yeah.
So Gibson selling anything?
Yeah, SGs.
No, but they obviously weren't setting that many of them.
Well, they were. I mean, that was their guitar of the moment. The Les Paul was discontinued, and they went, okay, well, we do the SG now.
And they were still doing 335s and 330s and all that sort of thing as
The Les Paul had been deemed kind of not to work almost, because they went, oh yeah, that was great. You know, he promoted it and brilliant. And he was a big star. Through the 50s and in the early 60s, and then his kind of star waned a bit, I think, and they went, okay, we'll see you later. But we've done your signature model now, and you know, we tried to give you another one in the SG, and you weren't really into it, so
but
see you later,
they,
we won't do Les Pauls anymore.
Weren't they fairly expensive to produce as well? Because obviously they were much more hands-on than Fenders were, and Fenders were just like getting them out. They were just like mass-produced, really, weren't they?
So, well, I mean, I think this was the other thing, is that
the modular guitar.
Yeah. The way that Gibson were produced meant that it was quite an expensive
process
thing to make, I think.
It's funny how they went to something so totally different, almost, though.
Well, the SG.
Yeah,
I mean, especially when you think about it at the time, I mean, it's pretty abrasive-looking. Even now, it's quite... abrasive looking, and to go from something relatively conservative.
Well, I mean, especially something that was like flame maple top, solid mahogany, quite thick, quite chunky, to an SG, which is generally
super slimline.
Yeah,
it does seem to be quite a jump. But anyway, so there was a period of time where there wasn't a Les Paul, and you know, like I said, Keith Richards kind of picked one up, and then of course people like Eric Clapton and stuff on with the Blues Breakers kind of made it popular again, and Gibson went, oh yeah, we should probably make some more of those, so people can actually buy them now that everyone's playing one who's kind of a prominent player. George Harrison, obviously, with that red one, and So yeah, I mean, that's the reason, although it kind of happened just before the 70s, that was kind of the first note that I made about the 1970s, is the Les Paul really comes back into fashion in the early 70s, I guess.
Well, when they did the Gibson did the custom shop Mark Bolan.
Yeah.
I mean, so many like customers would come in and be, oh, I remember playing one of them, Top of the Pops. And I think that was like, you know, that was one of those, because that's, I think that is a 68 with a custom
it's
neck,
like a 60s
it?
Body with a 70s neck.
Yeah, because I think the headstock snapped, didn't it?
And he replaced the neck with a custom ebony one. Bound. It's quite a weird looking guitar, that. Mm. But when you think about players around that time, you know, like big 70s guitarists, so I guess like Jimmy Page, people like Mick Ronson,
yeah,
famously played like Les Paul custom. At the other end of the spectrum, someone like Steve Jones from Sex Pistols, who recently had a signature based on his 70s custom that we had in.
Yeah.
He starts to pick up in popularity a bit later, but someone like Randy Rhodes was Les Paul custom as well. And you think all those big rock guitar tones, Gary Moore from Thin Lizzy, again, at that point in his career, probably a Les Paul.
Yeah, it wasn't until later on, which we'll probably get to, when he started using all the other sort of guitars.
Kind of more metal-y sort of pump, yeah. Stuff.
Do you think maybe all of this was helped by, of course, the 70s, the mid-70s, we saw the big Fender buyout and, you know, the relatively notorious dip in quality?
I just think, in general, there was just a pretty general dip in quality across the board with all brands like Fender. And, you don't see many people going, you do pick up some good guitars, but, I mean, people don't go, yeah, my mid-70s Les Paul. You know, people will still just talk about a 59 or a 58. And I just think that, you know, people then, mid-70s, they were 20-year-old guitars that people were just like, yeah, it's an old guitar, isn't it? It's not like it wasn't like a vintage
kit. No, vintage didn't exist.
And then I suppose because people just grew up listening to people play it from, you know, the early 60s, and then you get into the 70s, they were like, yeah, cool, I can get one of those, and I can get one cheap because I can get one second-hand. I suppose it was the same sort of vibe, really.
Yeah, it's certainly, for the big American guitar manufacturers, the 70s not only marks a kind of quite popular period, I guess, before almost the decline in the 80s and early 90s. Mm. You know, people were using Strats, Teddy's, Les Pauls from the big companies.
Mm.
But it does also mark a kind of dip in quality, as you say. Like, so on the Gibson side of things, we saw things like the sandwiching, where they would use bodies were made out of like the top and the back were mahogany,
yeah,
and there was a maple like strip in the middle.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw one, and I can't remember how long it was, and I called you and I was like, well, this is like 70s Les Paul this customer's bought in, and it's like made of three bits of wood, but not like three, like a top. It was like, it looks like a sandwich.
I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, they're really weird.
You can see them, if you're holding the guitar sitting down and looking down on the guitar, it is directly in the middle of the body, and it's about 2 or 3 mil thick. It's just a piece of maple that obviously is the same shape as the guitar, sandwiched in between a bit of mahogany that forms the top and the bit of mahogany that forms the back. Mm. It's really weird. To be honest, I don't actually know the reasoning behind
Nor
it.
Nor do I, actually, I'll be honest. But
There must have been something there, because, I mean, it's like an awful lot more work.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a cheaper, I mean, maples are much cheaper wood to source.
It was probably
two or three mil, you know.
Yeah. It's probably because they could, like, spread out the use of the mahogany, I suppose.
Yeah, something maybe. Like, there must be a production reason. Oh, maybe, I wonder whether it's to do with weight, perhaps, or...
Maple's heavy, though.
I mean, it could have been a tonal reason.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the mahogany they were finding they were getting were too dark, perhaps, in terms of tone. But, I mean, you look at, again, Fender, you know, the quality of woods that they were able to get also took a dive. You look at things like the Thin Line, where they wanted to make a guitar, you know, they wanted to keep making tellies, but the quality of the weight of the woods that they were getting at that time was a bit heavier than they were used to.
Yeah.
And certainly if you compare like a 70s standard telly to something like a 60s guitar, they're definitely heavier. I used to have an old 78 telly that weighed an absolute ton.
Yeah.
So that kind of, I guess, explains the Thin Line concept, is that they hollow out a bit of the guitar. And
it's funny, really, as time went on throughout the 70s, they definitely got, like, slightly worse and slightly heavier. But like the earlier you see, the closer to, like, late 60s you get, the sort of, you can just see it sort of then fading out. But it's that buyout, like you
it
say,
was
that
buyout
period,
of course,
which was, what, 76? No, it was 71, I think. Like that, they started phasing out because they started using.
Oh, right. Oh, not the buyout, you mean.
Well, yeah. I mean, I assume that also, I mean, the other thing that happened in that time, I mean, imagine the amount of guitars that they were producing, say, in 1956 through to 1960, compared to the amount of guitars that they were producing in 1971. You know, that whole kind of pop and rock boom that had happened in that time, all based around the electric guitar. Yeah, think about the difference. So they obviously had to make the guitars a bit cheaper, a bit more widely available, plus they were producing more, plus, like you say, there were other kind of corporate interests that may have been driving profit slightly.
I'm sure that we're going to talk about this more in the 80s, but certainly towards the end of the 70s would have seen all of the Japanese companies really come into play. And of course, I suppose it counts slightly more as 80s because they were kind of all sort of 78, 79, but a lot of the lawsuit era Fenders.
Yeah.
And kind of, I suppose, the birth of Ibanez was like at the time a Fender imitation company and a Gibson imitation
definitely
company.
I mean, that's kind of my other note really for the 70s, is the kind of rise of Japan, and seeing companies like Ibanez going, oh yeah, that Les Paul there, we can build that in Japan much cheaper, better quality, and you know, we're not going to be restricted by the problems that you're having in terms of churning this number of guitars out or making it to a certain price point. And some of the Japanese stuff you see around that time, you know, people like Ibanez and CSL and companies like that, the quality is incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's easily up there with Fender or Gibson at the time, I guess. Matt, just quickly, we'll talk about Japan a bit more in a bit when we go into the 80s, because I guess they started gathering a lot more kind of pace when we get to the 80s. What are we looking at amp-wise when we're talking about the 70s? I mean, I guess Marshall, the image that I have of 70s classic rock is a Les Paul Standard with a Marshall stack.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much the... I mean, you suppose you saw people... Once again, I suppose it was that thing of... And we do talk about it a lot, people kind of using what they could get in terms of, you know, second-hand amps and stuff like that. But yeah, Marshall generally, because you saw things like the super huge, like, plexi heads and stuff like that coming... I'll say coming back in. I mean, it was sort of the... Late 60s, I suppose, they started producing those.
I mean, I guess when you think of that image of, like, Hendrix towards the end of the 60s, like Woodstock, that sort of thing, that's all Marshall stacks.
Yeah.
And again, I was thinking, like, you know, Led Zeppelin.
I suppose they were the loudest, probably the loudest amps around, really, at that point. Well, and that's what a lot of people wanted.
In this country, you know, it all comes down to that kind of availability again. You know, because they were made in this country and because they were kind of the biggest amp brand, I guess, alongside Vox in this country, people would have had access to them. Mm. Whereas, you know, they might not have access to, you know, say Fender or other American brands quite as easily.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, nowadays, you know, there's so many, you know, guitar shops like us that do a wide range of amp brands. You know, you couldn't just go down to Denmark Street and go, yeah, you got any of those really weird boutique amps from such and such, you know.
I guess it's wherever. The same.
It's just like, you know, you would have seen what was built locally. Yeah.
Orange as well, like, you know, that would be the other, the main kind of 70s tone, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, you would see quite a lot of Orange around that time as well.
Yeah, a lot to do with all, like, preamp gain, so just, like, just cranking everything up and letting the valves do all the work, really.
And again, British made.
Yeah.
So, just to sum up, kind of 70s wise, what should people be looking at today if they really want that kind of rich, thick 70s classic rock sound?
Well, I think in terms of the overall rig, keep it simple. So, probably just plug guitar straight into the amp.
We haven't actually talked. What was going on on the pedal scene in the 70s?
Not loads. Because you think Boss, we were talking about this earlier, Boss started producing the single pedals, the compact pedals, in 77. So that's like much later towards the end. And then there was always like companies messing around with pedals in the late 60s and early 70s, like Ampeg did, like a load of like really rare pedals that you see now, like the EMS Synthy Hi-Fly, which was used by...
What is that? That sounds amazing.
It was a box that you opened up, and it was a guitar synthesizer, and it had three pedals in it, and then it had little... They stood about 3 foot tall, and then you like sat in front of it, and it was a huge box, like a suitcase that you opened up, and it had a a Univibe, a Fuzz, and an octave divider in it, and then each one was foot controlled, and it came in its own little carry suitcase. Morley did a voice box that actually was called like the bag, and it was like a huge bag that you like squeeze like a bagpipe.
I love this. I mean, obviously, you know, Boss kind of took the world by storm with the compact pedals and things like that, but what they've also done is kind of standardised what you think of as a guitar effect.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, all right, Morley were a fairly big manufacturer of pedals in the 70s. Things like the Echo flange they did stood about half a foot tall off the floor and then had a foot controller on top of it.
Yes.
I mean, I think
on top of it?
Yeah, so it was like a huge,
so it's like
block.
Standing on a wedge monitor.
Yeah, pretty much.
Maybe that's where that came from. People just like were used to
maybe using Morley flanges.
I just, there wasn't, like you say, there wasn't like a standard mini, but you see old, like, for example, Tone Benders, which were big in the late 60s, early 70s, and they're like huge metal boxes.
That's the Fender Fuzz thing,
the,
is that right?
The Solar Sound. Like, so, the,
yeah, okay.
But yeah, all the pedals from them were like massive. And I think, yeah, like you say, Boss were the ones that kind of standardised it into a smaller size.
I kind of miss that. I love the idea of a guitar effect turning up and it's in a bag.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense. Just,
it's 100% analogue.
Yeah.
Just uses the wind.
Wind powered. Eco-friendly.
Yeah, you can only play it outside.
Yeah.
But all those 70s pedals are just, yeah, just ridiculously massive.
Kind of, I suppose, weird. Even like Leslie speakers are kind of a first step towards,
well, that. I mean, yeah. Like one of the more like Mutron, like biphasers and like auto-wires and stuff, just like huge boxes with like massive switches on. And I think it's,
that's
because
what I want. I want an effect pedal with a big lever on it.
Just a big,
yeah,
just
some
it.
Sort of like train track style lever.
Yeah.
Jukebox thing,
yeah,
like one up to bandit.
You pull the, yeah,
freezer.
You don't know what effect you're gonna get. There's three different.
I hate, that's not a jukebox.
Not a jukebox.
One on bandit.
Yeah, that's gambling machine.
Not a jukebox. Jukebox is where you play music.
That's right.
But then I suppose
this has been the GAK podcast with Jay Cross.
But like, we've just.
I long for the day when none of us three can make it. And Jay has to fly solo for an hour. Can you imagine?
It would just be an hour of spoonerisms.
Yes.
But what I was going to say was, it's, I think, as we've mentioned, talked about a lot in the guitar front, where manufacturing changed a lot, probably because, you know, we say of quality, I think just because of the amount they had to build, they obviously had to change the way they built things. And with pedals and amp manufacturers, I think it's just all experimenting. And then in the 80s, and then probably gradually now through to the 90s and now, is when everything's kind of,
it's kind of more standardised,
yeah,
across the board.
And
just quickly, I mean, I suppose one thing that I haven't written down here, but something that for me, I guess, stems from the 70s and they still work in a similar way now, would be electroharmonics.
Yeah, actually.
Formed, built in, sort of started in the late 60s, is that
when,
right?
When was the Big Muff?
The first Big Muff was 68.
Was that their first pedal? I assume it was.
No, the
was
first pedal was the Linear Power Booster, which was the little,
LPB.
The
really?
LPB, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Basically, Mike Matthews, who founded the company.
And is still in charge?
Still in charge, yeah. And now he has a huge white beard. Okay. Like the biggest white beard.
Is he the dude on the batteries?
Yeah, yes. He's the dude on the batteries. Yes. It doesn't look like that much, because he's got like a massive like Father Christmas beard.
Yeah, he's like the Father Christmas of pedals.
He had an idea, and he got a technician in, and they built the, he said, oh, I need something that I can plug into my guitar, but just makes it louder. And the original LPB1 actually plugged directly into the guitar, and then that you plug the lead from that into,
oh really, what, yes. like a pitch jack,
well,
like that.
Imagine the amp plug. So it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
an amp plug, and then you go from that, and then,
but the LPB's got a valve in it, doesn't it?
No,
the LPB2 Ube used to have
who were the company that used to do, they did like the little purple box and the orange box, Dan Armstrong, who made the Plexi guitars,
yeah,
did them, and they did like a fuzz, because then before the Big Muff, or maybe just after Big Muff, they just did one called the Muff Fuzz,
yeah,
and it was just a Big Muff that plugged directly into the guitar.
Right.
Oh, we have to get one of those.
I've been trying to get one for ages.
That'd
just
because so
you just
good.
Plug it straight in. You can't even turn it on or off. It's just odd.
Yeah. Why would you want it off?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why would you not need fuzz all
but
the time?
Yeah, I think one of the first ones was, yeah, they made the Big Muff. And then, yeah, supposedly Hendrix used one. That's always the big thing. It's like, yeah, man, Hendrix used one in the studio. But there's never been, like...
You know that if that happens, you will have a brand forever.
Yeah.
Do you know
yeah.
what I mean? The day that Jimi Hendrix records with the Big Muff, you're like, yep, yeah, Electro-Harmonics. But if only we ever just make the Big Muff, we'll kind of never
and actually, if you think
not
about
be
it,
a brand.
They were probably one of the only brands that had a solid output of effect pedals throughout... From the 70s just onwards,
but they
really.
went under, didn't they? We were talking about this the other day, Joe. That Electro-Harmonics, although they're kind of they've been a brand for a long time, they've kind of gone into like receivership and stuff a few times.
Yeah. They've been right on the ropes throughout. But
I think they went bust, and then he went, oh well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to manufacture valves in Russia.
Was saying that he bought a valve factory kind of on a whim. It was just kind of going cheap. And he went, yeah, maybe we'll make some valves and kind of put Electro-Harmonics on them, or Sovtek, or whatever.
Well, I don't think they had Electro-Harmonics at that point. Yeah, that's where Sovtek came from. And then when Sovtek did so well, he just went, oh, I'll relaunch Electro-Harmonics.
And then is that where the Russian Big Muff came from?
Yeah, exactly.
And then
yeah,
I think that's where...
Just because he had this manufacturing facility in Russia. In Russia, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the pedals that you see now... You forget that actually it's really a reissue of something they did like ages ago. Like loads of the pedals that they have on the market now were out in the 70s and then obviously were discontinued. And then,
in fact, the reason that we were talking about them earlier is one of the only things they haven't reissued, which you desperately want, is the Hot Hand, which is essentially a wah pedal that's got a mechanism in it that has like a wire that comes out almost that you then clamp round the control on any of your pedals, and then it turns that control while you rock the wah pedal.
We mentioned it briefly, I think, a couple of podcasts ago, something like that.
It's an absolutely brilliant idea. I think we were talking about it the other day in the shop
But they did some. They had some crazy stuff. They had like a light controlled wah. It was called the Soul Kiss, and it was a little pedal with a tube that came off with a light at the end, and then you put it in your mouth like a voice box, but as the more light and less light went in, it opened and closed like a little tone circuit, like a wah. And they were like super, super unpopular. they didn't sell any, and now they go for like loads of money. It's just one of those things. But like I think we mentioned, the Microsynth was originally helped designed by one of the guys Zoom, like the Moog stuff.
Really? Moog. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I didn't know that either. Matt was telling me.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
But yeah, all the... But amazingly, then and today, still all built in New York. Still,
are they still in the same factory they're always in, or did they lose that when they went to Russia?
I don't know about the factory, but they are still all built in America.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, really, considering a Big Muff is what, 58 quid.
That was why there was that. That was why there was that shortage.
Yeah,
a couple of years ago.
Was it? That's right. After
one of the hurricanes.
Yeah.
Not Katrina. No, we've made this mistake before.
Okay.
That one that was really
bad. The one that was in the northeast.
Yes.
Because we couldn't get Big Muffs for ages.
We couldn't get anything, yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, but the big thing, going back to what you were saying about how, you know, as long as you always sell Big Muffs, they'll still be a company. We couldn't get Big Muffs for ages. I mean, probably, I don't know, 6 months?
Yeah, something
that's right.
Like that.
The entire building had flooded,
yeah,
didn't it?
They just lost everything.
So Matt, to sum up, the 70s, we kind of went on a detour of 70s pedals there. What would you suggest that people get now if they want that kind of like 70s? I'm thinking like Led Zeppelin, like Mick Ronson. I mean, it's got to be a Les Paul, hasn't it?
I mean, realistically, I think if we were going to say a 70s like rock tone, then I would say it's got to be June Page, so it's got to be a Les Paul, really.
Yeah.
So if you go for like, what would you say if you were doing it on a budget, Les Paul Studio, or you could go for like a 50s or a 50s tribute, something like
that.
Yeah, LPJ. That's got P90s in. Yeah, an LPJ.
I think the LPJ is great. I was talking to someone. I mean, I talk about LPJs every day, but I was talking to someone today about LPJs. You know, they every time I sort of look at one and plug one in, I'm just constantly amazed at how good they are. You know, they're like 550 quid. The same pickups that you get in a Les Paul custom, they just don't look as nice. And you know,
it's a great studio guitar.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
It's everything
that
kind of the original like Les Paul Studio was kind of meant to be. It's just an absolutely brilliant.
I mean, there's no way around it. They don't look very nice. You know, there's no point in pretending that they do. But they sound great and they feel great. I mean, I really like that unlacquered body. That's I think it feels really, really nice. And aesthetically, I mean,
well, do you remember,
but I think it's definitely, I mean, if you think about, okay, is it worth saving 400 quid for having something that doesn't look quite as nice?
I mean, worth mentioning now that if you want to do Les Paul on a budget but you want to go up from the LPJ, I would say that Les Paul Studio 2 Deluxe is a really good option now as well, which has got the boost on there and also the core taps, is that right, on the push-push?
Yeah.
It's the same as the traditional Pro 2s as well.
Yeah, and they've on the studios, they've just done some new colours. So initially they were like block colours.
Yeah.
Now there is Cherry Sunburst,
Silver Burst,
Tobacco Burst, and another burst that isn't Silver Burst. There is a Silver Burst, but honey? There's also, yeah, like a Honey Burst. Yeah. And they're no money. Can you remember how much Studio 2 Deluxes are?
They're $999.
There we go. £1,000, and you've got yourself, you know, something that's got nearly as good a top as a studio. A standard, which is, what, £2,000 now?
I'm looking forward to when we can, because I don't know if anything changed while I was away, but announcing all of the new 2014 models.
We cannot yet announce. We're unbongoed on those till 2014, I think.
Yeah.
On the topic of the LPJ as well, and them not looking very nice, I'm sure we've mentioned it before, but Foles bought an LPJ from us and had it sprayed at a local Brighton motorcycle. But because they're just like such a plain blank canvas, they had a really detailed black and white airbrushing finish put on an LPJ.
It was really nice guy called Dennis.
Yeah, I can't remember their name.
Deluxe. Okay. Yeah, he primarily does motorcycle stuff, as you say. But he started branching out into guitars. He did one for as you say, did one for Foles. I think he did one for Wiz Khalifa as well.
Oh, really? I mean, the job he did in the Foles one looked amazing. Incredible.
Yeah, that's just reminded me. I've seen the Wiz Khalifa guitar because that came from us. Didn't
it did. Yeah. They both did. Yeah. Well, because Dennis lives in Hove, lives around the corner.
Okay.
Super nice dude. Like, I've had a couple of quotes go to him as well. He's really, like, his stuff is incredible. Really, really nice. So if you want like a custom paint job, it kind of is like nothing is too avant-garde for him. Some of the stuff he's done is really, really amazing. So you should look it up. It's I think the website is D-LUCKS. D-Lux.
Yeah, that's right.
Really, really cool.
Matt Knight, what if someone wanted a kind of 70s sounding amp these days, probably thinking Marshall or Orange, would you probably
towards? I was, you know, while you guys were talking, I was thinking, right, that's going to be the next question. I was thinking, right, would I do a Marshall? I'd say Orange.
Okay.
Because I think that a lot of Marshalls now probably lean towards more of a lot of stuff that you probably saw in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And I think for Orange, a guy who works here who's really big into like Matamp and Orange and that kind of 70s vibe, I'd go for an OR15. So
they're
like,
so cool.
They're just so, because obviously the OR20 was like the ultimate 70s Orange amps, 120 watts, just like loads of power, loads of like preamp gain, and that is obviously realistically too loud for most people. So now R15 single channel, just really beefy sounding.
It's kind of got that
fuzzy sort of raw quality to it. So if you're kind of doing a Jimmy Page sort of thing, it's not like the 80s where you get into that kind of real pristine saturated gain. It's sort of
It sounds raw around the edges. Definitely. R15 I was really surprised by, because I think they came in while I was away or something, or there seemed to be a time for some reason where everyone had heard one and I hadn't heard one, and one day someone just went, you should really try that out, they're a really good sounding amp. I plugged it in and just went, yeah, that's proper, that sounds like what you expect from Orange for not huge money.
And you plug it into a 412, sounds huge. I remember the first thing we did when they first came in was we just closed. And I think I was cashing up, so I was around the front with a couple of other people, and then all of a sudden this raucous noise came out from around the corner. We all went round. Yeah, it was just a OR15 plugged into a PPC 412, and everyone was stood like 20 foot away because they couldn't get any closer than that without it hurting your ear. It was actually absolutely massive.
Yeah.
So we're saying LPJ or Les Paul Studio Deluxe with an OR15 and a cab.
And loads of Electro-Harmonix pedals.
Just all of them. Yeah. All of them on at once.
Well, the funny thing is, just quickly here, in terms of if you wanted to know, they actually produced the first ever Stompbox flanger, the first ever analog delay with no moving parts, the first ever guitar synthesizer, and the first tube amp distortion simulator.
Wow. What was the tube amp distortion simulator called?
The Hot Tubes, which they've just reissued in the Hot Tubes Nano, which sounds wicked for about £39.
Have we got those in stock
yet? Yeah, yeah. The Hot Tubes Nano, the OD Glove, and the East River Drive.
Yeah, we need to do some video demos on those, yeah. I think, because we've not done anything on those yet. And apparently, they all sound very, very good. The East River Drive's been getting really, really
it's
good
It's got
reviews.
A proper, like, JRC chip in it, so like a proper Tube Screamer style overdrive chip in it. So.
Maybe we'll do those tomorrow.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me. Now, Matt Knight, let's talk about your favourite period of time ever.
The 80s.
The 1980s. What was going on in the guitar world in the 1980s?
Oh, let's talk about rack units and how everyone should now own a... I was saying to you when you mentioned what we're doing, I was like, maybe I'll just start buying all the rack units
you
again.
You were talking about that last week and I thought you were joking.
I don't know. I mean, I think that was a time when obviously all this technology, all that sort of technology was new, and everything from the 70s we've just talked about was like, why would you want that? It's old.
Why would you want a valve amp? Why would you want a plexi? Why would I ever want that? It's old. You know, what I want is a solid state rack power amplifier.
Yeah. Valve driven preamps into a solid state 2000 watt preamp or power amp of some sort that drives six monitors,
preferably with a built-in permanent chorus.
Yeah,
of course. It's the 80s.
Yeah,
of course.
But you did start seeing the rise of, you know, things like Digitech 2120, which is I think kind of the quintessential rack modeling effects box, and in fact that might not have even been out until the 90s, but that sort of headed that way, really.
I mean, for me, for someone who loves pedals, if the 80s hadn't happened, where'd we be now? Like, I mean, the thing is, you know,
in the 70s, like,
yeah.
permanently
just in the 70s on a loop. Things like, take for example, the Eventide pitch factor or something like that, which has got all these crazy like pitch algorithms and stuff, all of that comes from rack technology that was about £6,000 in the 80s that they can now put into boxes that cost, you know, a tenth of the price.
Think about the Boss DD series was originally rack, wasn't it?
The DD,
whatever the first digital delay pedal was, the DD2?
No, they were all compacts. There was a lot of digital rack units. They didn't do a...
I thought...
They did do some mini racks,
I thought the chip from the DD3, I was sure
the chip from the DD3 was the same as the DD2. They're basically the same.
Okay,
unit.
The chip from the DD2, I thought that was from one of the...
It was probably from one of the Roland units. Like, Roland did a lot in the late 70s, early 80s, like when all these people were starting to make units.
I thought it was the same chip, and part of the reason it took them a little bit of time to... Maybe. Get it in was they couldn't make the box
well enough.
We'll
have to contact Jamie on that one.
Or, as we've discovered, I discovered yesterday, you're friends with the head of Boss on Facebook.
Yeah, and we've been talking about running, of all things.
I know.
And then I mentioned, I'm really jealous to Jamie from Boss. And he went, you should... Like, maybe you should come out. I was like, yes, please.
Yes,
yes, please, let me come out to your factory.
If we can podcast from Japan, that would be very good.
Yeah.
What is running? Is it a new pedal?
Yeah, I don't know what running
the
is.
Like
flanger.
The RU2. RU2?
Yeah.
It's just a delay that makes you sound like the Edge.
So, as well as kind of rack gear and more, I mean, I guess the rise of digital pedals, really, things like the DD2s and, you know, people starting to move away from analog circuits and build things, you know, like the first multi effects, I guess, are kind of 80s, the first digital multi effects are 80s.
You see a lot of them, you still see a lot of them now come up every now and then, like big old, like chunky floor units.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they're all digital. And the thing is, they sort of, at the time, I suppose they sounded good, and then for a while they sounded horrible, and now they're starting to sound good again.
Back in fashion, yeah, like through the 90s and 2000s, it was like, why would I ever want digital? That sounds terrible.
Yeah.
But now, actually, if you could get your hands on like a DD2, you'd be like, yeah, I want that. I really want that.
Like the old, was it the PS2, which I think I saw pop up on Facebook, which is the old pitch shifter delay.
Every guitar, weirdly, because Jay put this up, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, the guy from Boss, great that he'd found one. And I realised that I've been in four bands ever, and every guitarist I've ever worked with has had one on his board. I thought they were a really standard pedal.
No.
They're actually super rare.
I used to have the RP10, which was the mini rack unit, which was effectively the same circuitry in a mini rack, but somehow I managed to, it was a pitch shifter and a delay, but you could somehow tune it down a fifth so it sounded like a baritone and it was slightly polyphonic, but for some reason when you turn the delay to a certain point it just put everything in reverse. There was like some sort of weird thing where if you put the controls a certain way it gave you like reverse delay, so you could have like a reverse
baritone.
Yeah,
it's the sound that everyone wants.
But I sold it to a mate who then went and bought every other rack unit and then bought the same one again, so now he's got all of them, that and that one as a spare, and he won't sell it back to me.
Ah, damn,
the one that got away.
Yeah,
so I would say that along with that kind of digital rack gear and more kind of advanced digital tech, I mean, the other thing that I guess defines the 80s is the pointy headstock guitars. Jackson, Ibanez,
Charvel.
Charvel. I mean, to an extent, although they started in the 80s, I guess BC Rich. They started in the 70s even, BC Rich. I mean, would you say those are the kind of quintessential guitars for that period?
Pointy, yeah.
I mean, I think we should also remember that the 80s was the birth of, for bass, both extended range and active circuitry.
And headless.
And headless as well, yeah. All, you know, three things
was
that
in,
are...
Was the 80s, there'd never been a five-string before?
Well, I'm sure there had. No, I think there were late 70s, and I think it was Alembic or Status, one of those two people that brought something out in the late 70s that was your first extended range. But I think the 80s were really the first time we started hearing low B as kind of more commonplace then than it is today.
And
slap bass, yeah, came into its own.
You know. What's the theory behind headless basses? I've never really understood that. Like, is it purely aesthetics, or is there some science there?
I think there's some sort of.
Well, I would assume it's a tuning thing because they're locked in. At the bridge, and a lot of the time they'll have a kind of locking nut as well.
Yeah, it's a tension thing. And
yeah,
stuff like that.
But I would assume that most people got them in the 80s because people were kind of trying to move away from the 70s. Like, you know, all the 70s, I think at the time, was almost like a carryover from the 60s. Like, the late 60s seems to extend till about 1976, and then you start getting like punk and people doing like new wave and stuff like that. And then it moved into this kind of futurist.
Well, yeah, that's
thing
exactly
really
what it was.
It was
all about high fidelity. Everyone wanted to make everything as polished as they could. And things like that, a headless instrument was kind of like a streamlined version of a guitar. I mean,
the first time I remember seeing one was watching some video of Bad Brains back in like 79 or something.
Yeah.
No, that doesn't make sense.
Later than that.
But Bad Brains was the first people. But it's just so weird, you know, for you to say that it is like, you know, it's a futurist thing when I don't know. I just never really understood where the theory came from.
I think with Steinberger, especially, like Ned Steinberger was like really into the. I think, like, as you see now with the ZT3s, the trans trems, that was just generally really into the instrument on a whole another level.
And that I think really defines the era, is that kind of striving for the perfection. You know, you see things like locking trems. The reason for those is people saying, well, you know, I want to do extreme things with the trem, but a Strat trem just won't do it for me. You know, it will go out of tune because I'm pushing the trem right into the body.
I mean, the sound that always gets me, I think, is chorus and compression for the 80s. Those two things
almost
combined.
Definitely.
You know.
You basically just said Billy and Sheehan.
Right there. But, you know, not just in bass, but in guitars as well.
Absolutely.
Really, like... I mean, Prince is a really good example of a lot of guitar working, especially in the late 70s and the 80s, that kind of...
A lot of chorus
and a lot of compression and, well, ridiculous guitars. EMGs.
Yeah, active... I mean, like you mentioned,
on bass, but also carried
over to guitars,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think really sparked that in the 80s? Why the active pickups?
Well, I mean, again, it's exactly the same answer as what we were speaking about with headless. It was that high fidelity. It was that striving to make everything. I suppose before, maybe it wasn't before. Certainly now, when we're trying to use older gear, we're striving for character and individuality in our sound. And I think in the 80s, they started striving for this really perfect, clean sound that you could only get if you took all of the character out of it, all the subtle nuances. They wanted that real kind of mechanical feel to everything.
Interesting that you see effects like fuzz kind of fade into the background. Like, can you name a good 80s fuzz?
Well, no, exactly.
But it's more about that tight, punchy distortion. It's more
everything from The Cure to Prince, you know. Yeah, it's all about, you know, to I suppose even Mr. Big and stuff like that.
It's things like the Boss OD-1, you know, those sort of things where they were used in conjunction with the drive channel on a preamp or like a rack system to just give you just, you know, a real kind of, there's no like lines, you know, everything was just like a real pure signal almost, just like there's, it's not raucous like plugging in an OR-15 or like a Big Muff.
Yeah. It really is that about that.
It's very
super
controlled
defined.
And defined.
So you can just, it was almost like having an, in fact, we had a second hand amp once. I can't remember what it was called, but you remember it had an infinite gain on it. You could just almost keep turning up the gain and it just got more and more distorted, but it never kind of, it sort of never got too out of control. It was just, you could just keep adding gain and it just got more and more saturated until it almost became, it's like a, still just like a pure note. It's really, I can't remember what it was.
If anyone can kind of put a name to that amp, they were built in Brighton.
Guy who helped design Vox.
And they
amps. had a Vox AC30 preamp system or something in it.
And that this was their big selling point, that it had infinite gain. You could literally just keep turning the knob and it would keep kind of getting more distorted. It was like a bit of a weird thing.
Yeah,
it
was. Yeah, if anyone could put a name to that, then email us podcast@gak.co.uk.
Actually, I thought of one guitar, browsing here on the internet while I was thinking. I just thought I'd put in 80s guitars. Explorer. With like Hetfield, we talk about Metallica. I mean,
again, this comes back, like we were saying, the kind of rise of Japan. You see brands like ESP, come in and do some of the stuff with Metallica, and like we've said, the pointy headstocks in the form of Ibanez, and very much that kind of hair metal, you know, lycra trousers, fluorescent pink,
modern
Ibanez
finishes
RGs
as well, matte finishes, pinks, things like that. Yeah. They were not something that had really been in abundance before.
No, you know, Gibson and Fender certainly hadn't done a hot pink guitar.
The closest we'd probably had is when George Harrison hand painted his Strat.
Coming to think of it, like, I guess like BC Rich and stuff had started doing it at the end of the 70s, but it really is when, you know, Jackson come in and Ibanez come in, loads of airbrushing, ridiculous
colours.
And Fender just hadn't done that.
When was
LED
the
fretboards?
Oh,
it's the dream.
Good. The fret light.
Yeah, I'm thinking.
Do you remember when
done?
Were you here when we had the secondhand Mark King Alembic here, and it took 5 9-volt batteries?
Oh god.
Because it had 2 18-volt preamps and then 1 battery to control all the lights.
I remember that. Yeah.
That was pretty special.
That was awesome.
That sounds perfect.
The other thing I wanted to talk about in the 80s is, and it ties in with the kind of rise of Japan. Obviously, Fender saw all these companies building Fender copies, you know, companies like Ibanez and like companies like Phoenix are a bit more obscure, but
ooh,
were building,
nice. Good reference.
You know, in the, I know, in the Matsumoto
Young
factory. And Fender went, okay, well, you know, we can't stop them doing this because, you know, we haven't got a copyright over the body shape. We've only got it on the headstock. What we'll do is we'll build our own Japanese guitars, the birth of Squire. And really, the birth of officially licensed budget guitars.
Yeah.
I don't think before, you know, Gibson had done some cheaper guitars in the form of things like L6Ss and weird guitars, but no one had gone, right, we're going to do another brand.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it was probably also the first time, I think, you saw, since they'd started making them, I think it's the first time Fender lost their mantle as being, for bass guitars, I think, as being the bass guitar to play, just because they weren't doing active stuff.
And
Squire was, I think Squire were kind of their attempt to bring him in line, sorry.
It wasn't really an 80s instrument, was it?
Well, no,
in terms
of
bass playing.
I actually think the Yamaha BB might be the bass guitar, to summarise the 80s. The BB that we have available now in the 44 and the 1024 are passive and are very much rock instruments. But when the BB was originally introduced in the 80s, it had a three-band EQ on it. And that was actually even rare, because active circuitries had been two-band for when they first started and first came out. And this was one of the very first to be three-band. And if you watch a lot of session players and backing bands for a lot of pop stuff going around in the 80s, it's all Yamaha BBs. And it actually, another good example of people always trying to sound like that as well, is I have a friend called Sparky, not the Sparky that used to work here, who had a late 60s precision bass. He's an older chap, and he'd owned that from new, and he still plays it today, but now it's got like a battery box in it and EMGs, because in the 80s that's what he did, that's what everyone did. Yeah. Everyone took their old Fenders and were like, I don't want to sound like this anymore.
Yeah, it was a set that of really EMGs. Does kind of characterize most of the 80s, is that, you know, people, it had to be that one more thing, you know. It's like, okay, well, we've taken the P-Bass design, we've put a jazz pickup in it, or we've added active circuitry, or we've made it headless, and it is that one step away from kind of, you know, making yourself apart from what came before, is what summarised the 80s, I guess. Just quickly, let's talk about the birth of Squire. So 1982, or 1981, 82, 83, I guess, yeah, are the first years of Squire. I think it's 82 officially. Squire bring out, or Fender bring out, the Fender branded Squire JV series, mm-hmm, Japanese vintage, and the first one to actually have a big Fender logo on the headstock.
That's right, and
with
Squire
a small logo.
In hyphens.
Some of the most sought after guitars today, I would say, most sought after, but still vaguely affordable guitars.
Yeah, what are the other series? It's JV, I think. Is it silver?
SQ, yeah, which are your non-reissue series. So they were kind of your standards, I believe.
Yeah.
But the JVs are the one that everyone looks out for. Mm. I mean, I don't know if you guys have ever owned any of the JV stuff.
Nope. No, but I did borrow one. A guy used to work here had a JV, Graham had a JV P-Bass.
Yeah.
The black one with the tortoise shell guard.
Yeah, really nice 60s.
That was the one that was really heavy, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't. It was just like absolutely just spot on. It was just absolutely amazing. The bass
that Krista, who is our bass department guy, the bass that he owns is the one that I used to own, which is one of the 50s reissues. One of the best basses I've ever played.
Is that a JV one?
Yeah, it's a JV. Yeah, it's the 50s reissue. So it's really, really chunky maple, like block maple neck. Mm. And Fiesta Red, and they did 50s and 60s on either. So the one that you've tried was the one with the Rosewood,
yeah,
60s reissue, and they did it on Strats and Tellys as well. Yeah, I mean, those guitars, they go for crazy money, up to about £1,000, £1,200, I think, yeah, on the basses.
Bear in mind, it was introduced as a budget guitar.
I know, so funny. And the funny thing is that the one that I used to own, which was the 50s one, I think actually now you can get a guitar for much less money that is very similar but a bit better. The Matt Freeman. Uh-huh. People should be buying those up now. I'm just saying it now. That guitar is going to be worth loads of money in the future.
You reckon?
Yeah.
I think it's got potential.
I think they're absolutely killer. Yeah. I think they're absolutely killer. But do you really think it's like an investment piece?
Yeah, I do. I think it's slightly different because they're manufactured to a different level, in terms of there's probably a lot more Matt Freemans in the world now. If every shop has had 10,
yeah,
there's probably a lot more than there were Squire JVs.
They're the most expensive Squire bass in the catalogue.
But I just think, just get one now. If you like how they play, just get one, because I don't think they're going to be around for a huge amount of time.
He's a weird fella to have a like signature bass, like a signature. But I guess they I mean, your punk rock week that you did, you know, a few months ago. Like who's the fella from Strung Out?
Chris Aiken. Yeah,
it's a weird fella to have a.
We didn't actually do that video for.
No,
the
we didn't okay. do Aiken.
So, but he's a weird fella to have a signature. Like.
He is. Well, we were talking about this last week, actually. In that, I think there's a punk guy who deals with the A&R at Squire Basses.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at that, I mean, the only person I think isn't like a punk player is James Johnson from Biffy Clyro, and he's still like a young kind of hip guy.
He doesn't even play jazz basses.
Well, yeah, but I think that they've employed someone who's just gone, oh, right, so what music do I like? Well, I really like Rancid. I like Strung Out. My Chemical Romance, I'm into that. Blink 182. Fall Out Boy. I like all them.
Green Day.
Green Day.
Green Day, yeah.
I mean, how many... Mike Dirnt actually has three signature models kicking around at the moment. Well, yeah, because he's got the Squire.
Yeah.
And he's got the standard Fender model, and he's got a road-worn Fender model.
I mean, Mike Dirnt, I sort of understand, because Green Day are a kind of multi-million selling. Chris Aitken from Strung Out.
I know, I had to research
who Strung Out were.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, like, me and Mark are into punk, and not even we're into Strung Out. Like.
But at the same time, it's an amazing P bass with a mirror scratch plate and just a volume knob. It's like the perfect punk rock bass. But yeah, the one that I think people should be looking at really is the Matt Freeman. And we've got a little off track from the 80s, as we always do. Matt Knight, if someone was going to go for a quintessential 80s guitar setup, what should they be buying now?
I would go for... Amp wise, we didn't really mention it, but
well, no, because I guess kind of it is digital and rack stuff. People had preamps and power amps in a rack.
But if I was going to go for something which actually you'd listed on 70s, but actually I think you did see it a lot in the 80s, and people still do use it now. Roland Jazz Course.
Yeah, again, because it's
digital, solid state, loads of chorus.
Clean all the way up. It doesn't drive in any way.
And you can still buy one and they still sound awesome.
The Jazz Chorus is such a cool amp. I mean, apart from anything, or buy any Roland Cube and the clean sound is a Jazz Chorus.
Yeah. So, all right, so say if we're working on a budget, buy a Cube 40 GX, new Roland Cube.
Or Cube 80, small enough to Cube carry 80. Around, big enough to gig.
Easy. But yeah, those Jazz Choruses, the JC120, which is the current model, is such a cool amp.
I mean, the modelling on those is very good. So if you wanted to go for kind of more of the rock side of things, and because obviously it's something solid state, it gives you something a little bit more kind of crisp. And then I don't know, go for something more modern, like a Randy Rhodes, like a Jackson RR24, one of the Phil Demmel.
Phil Demmel would do it, or I guess if you kind of want something really authentic, Ibanez RG.
Yeah.
They basically haven't changed. They've upgraded the trim, they've put slightly different pickups in, but, you know, an RG, you know, mid-level RG from maybe the premium range.
And they do some incredible colours.
Well, they do. They still offer hot pink in a lot of the guitars and fluorescent yellow.
We were actually watching some videos of 80s tutorial videos of Paul Gilbert before we started the podcast. So.
And that's kind of got us fired up about
it.
I
don't know where that rabbit came from.
Yes, check out, what was that video called? Paul Gilbert
Magic Trick.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah, Paul Gilbert Magic Trick.
I'm the biggest cynic when it comes to guitarists, I guess.
Shreddy, over-the-top guitarists, I think, is what you mean.
But, like, that's sort of kind of... I've always sort of thought of people like that as a bit pretentious and a little bit, you know... But I've watched those videos of Paul Gilbert, and he obviously is, like, fully well aware of what he is.
He's the best one. He's someone who's learned to do something really well and then gone, why did I do that? It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And then I thought he was absolutely hilarious. He seems like a... Can we get him in to do the podcast at some point?
That would be amazing.
We were going to try and get him in at one point, because he's a Marshall endorsee now, I think.
Yeah, he hasn't got a signature, has he?
No.
But he plays Marshall at the moment.
No. Yeah, but just some of the guitars he played, just some of the colours.
The Fireman's amazing. Such a great guitar. You know, if you wanted to get like something... like a Explorer or a Destroyer or something along those lines, but didn't want to quite spend the money. I mean, how much is the Fireman? It's only like
799.
$799. Yeah, they're just under 1,000. I was about to say you could get an Explorer, but you can't get them.
Not
even in the catalogue next year, I don't think either.
Talking about Marshall players, let's move swiftly on to the 1990s when we were all not quite babies, but we were youngsters. And the return to classic gear.
In the 80s, dude.
Well, you know.
Like, Jay at the start of the 80s. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I forget.
Yeah.
Youngest there. Children.
Yeah. So, really, the 90s saw the return to classic gear. I guess, you know, with people like Nirvana, Oasis, all the kind of big rock acts like Pearl Jam, none of those guys are using rack gear, are they? They're using valve amps, you know. Kurt Cobain using the Mesa Boogie stuff and Marshalls and Fender, and all, it really is the return of all those brands. And certainly, you know, from the British side of things, you know, Noel Gallagher using Marshalls and Epiphone Sheratons or yeah. Dots or yeah. Les Pauls.
Riviera, I think he used, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, yes. I think it's Sheratons and Rivieras, and then later on there was the Noel Gallagher signature and stuff like
yeah.
that. But
yeah.
Was that the one that had, like, the Union Jack on
yeah,
it?
Or, yeah, or I think Man City
I think
Blue.
I think that was a Riviera, though, was yeah. The, yeah. The Union Jack.
I think one of my favourite stories about one of those guitars was Wayne Rooney's birthday.
Incredible.
His wife
Colleen
yeah bought him one, because he was a massive Oasis fan, yeah. bought him one of the signature ones, and got
Noel Gallagher
to sign it, but obviously he's a Man City supporter and he played for Manchester
Man United. Did he sign it?
He did.
Oh no. He had it refinished in Man City sky blue, and then signed it, and then gave it to Colleen to give to Wayne.
Very nice.
That's just a nice touch. That's an incredible touch. But it's so funny.
It's weird, isn't it? That, you know, you come out of a period where all the gear is kind of like hyper futuristic, locking trams, dive bombs, loads of digital delay, big reverbs, gated reverb, massive hair, spandex trousers.
God, and it was like heaven.
And then less than 10 years later, you've got Kurt Cobain wearing like a jumper and playing
a dress,
Fender Mustangs, sometimes a dress, Fender Mustangs through a boogie, and you know, a couple of years later than that, Noel Gallagher playing Les Pauls. You know, we're back to the 70s again.
It's funny, it just suddenly popped in my head, probably the most futuristic rig out of any band from kind of, especially like the early 90s, was probably Tom Morello.
Yeah.
Because he played an old Ibanez that had a Floyd Rose on it. It had a whammy pedal, a Phase 90, and a DSL. But that was like, if you look at like Slash and like you say, like Kurt Cobain, they were just
using normal valve amps with kind of 60s and 70s guitars. And it really, you know, it is that thing about it, it comes full circle. And I guess we're kind of still going through that period, really. I don't think we're back into the point where people want kind of pointy guitars.
I think the thing is now is that you've got so much. There's a real boutique market for real high end, like to the point sort of stuff, and then you've got things like Line 6 Dream Rigs, which are sort of a hybrid of the both, which are amazing. And I think the thing is everything sounds great now, and it's, you know,
it's affordable as well, yeah. Which is the other thing, you know, because that's everything's affordable. You can get good stuff at relative prices, you know.
Yeah I mean, it's funny really, when you know, especially when you talk about Oasis, and I mean, I remember seeing some early like shots, and I think he's using like his Epiphone
Les Paul
and an Orange Stack.
Yeah, and it's, I think the difference now, and kind of to draw this kind of retrospective to a close, is now, like you say, everything is available and everything's affordable.
Yeah.
So if, and everything's kind of acceptable, you know, if for example Kurt Cobain had come out with a headless, I don't know, BC Rich, people would have gone, wait, what's that? Like, because all of the big bands and all the kind of bands you could listen to were using like vintage gear.
Yeah.
Whereas now, you know, people are into like Meshuggah, who use pointy 8 strings, and that's still okay. You know, that's cool. That's kind of a fashionable music. But also at the same time, people are into Arctic Monkeys, where he just uses a Strat and a AC30 you know, Hot Rod Deluxe. Or
I think it, you know, now, I mean, you're slowly starting to see gear that's kind of, I think for a long time people were like, no, it's, you know, you, like I say, going back to being a purist almost. And I think now, like, some digital gear has just gotten so good, it's almost past the point where you could realistically, a lot of the time, tell the difference. I mean, if you look at Kempfer or the DV multi-amp, I mean, that, you know, you see a lot of bands, you know, like Meshuggah and Animals and Leaders and stuff like that, which are kind of big bands in that sort of scene, they just are using all modelling gear.
Do you think we've seen the end of kind of guitar trends then? Do you think that because everything is kind of okay, depending on what you're into?
Yeah.
Well,
I suppose in a sense we've...
Well, you say that, but we sit here week after week and harp on about Fender and Gibson.
Well, we do, but because that gear is really good. But we also talk a lot about, you know, Ibanez, and, you know, we've started a lot more talking about things like Jackson, because they're making really classy stuff that is affordable. And, you know, if your thing is that you want high gain and, you know, chunky distortion, you might want some EMGs. You know, we also talk a lot about ESP and LTD stuff as well. And for a player who wants that, that's still cool,
I mean,
you know.
I suppose you are right. I mean, yeah, I suppose everything is acceptable. There is, I mean, we're still selling Steinbergers, you know, as much as we're selling Fender Custom Shop heavy relics and things. Yeah.
I think, you know, if, for me, it comes down to, you know, a lot of people, if you're going to play guitar, you're probably going to play guitar because you listen to a certain set of bands who probably use some sort of guitar, and you go, and the first thing you do is you go, oh, I want to sound like that, or I want to learn that riff. And I think nowadays, with such a wider range of music you can listen to that's more easily accessible, I think that's just opened the doors for people to do kind of 8 strings, 9 strings, and like weird pedals and crazy amps and all this sort of thing. There's just a wider range of people out there who want a wider range of tones.
Actually, a funny example of that, this kind of how we've abandoned trends, I was watching a studio kind of rig rundown with the bass player from Thrice. And he had a really gorgeous old 70s Gibson Ripper, and he was recording into one of those Ampeg B series, the old valve combo single 15.
Sure.
I mean, and the thing looked, you know, as if it had moss growing off of it. It was really old. And bear in mind, they always play driven. His drive was on an M9. It was just
Line 6 M9.
Yeah, that was his recorded drive. So all this amazing vintage gear, and then, you know, probably the most modern digital pedal.
I think that is kind of the key now, is that kind of mix. You know, Matt, even looking at your rig, you know, when you're playing, you know, a vintage telly, but you're going into a lot of your pedals are digital, and they're, you know, preset heavy, and, you know, you use a multi-effects to some extent in the M5.
Yeah. I don't know. I think nowadays there's just like we say, there's so much good stuff out there. You plug it in, it sounds good.
Go for it.
Go for it.
Don't worry about the fashion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I couldn't name you that many modern bands, and I don't really sound like too many old bands. I just like pedals. Just plug me in.
Let's wrap up there. I'm really interested to hear people's kind of thoughts on this, really. You know, are guitar trends over? Have you ever bought anything or not bought anything because you were kind of scared of a trend, I guess? Email us in, podcast@gak.co.uk. Really interested to hear your thoughts. Gents, let's do some staff picks. Jay Cross, what have you been playing this week?
This week I have been super busy. And I
you say that every week.
I'm always busy. I wanted to quite often. The staff pick is like you turn up at 5:30 and we're still working. Then all of a sudden I'm like, oh no, I actually haven't really thought too much about this. And then I sort of have a wander around and go, oh yeah, that's cool. I wanted to have a bit more foresight this week. And so a couple of days ago...
You mean you've actually done some research for the podcast?
I've actually done a bit of research for the podcast. And this week I sat down and played the new Orange Amps. The solid state ones.
The Pro Crush.
The Pro Crush. The Crush Pro. Crush Pro series.
Sounds like a drink.
It sounds like a drink. But it's not a drink. It's an amp.
Jay Cross, source of all knowledge.
Tell us about this wonderful drink. I mean, amp.
Drink.
It's an amp.
So I sat down with it, and okay. So there's a couple. The one that I sat down with is the CR120, which is 120 watts.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't think that you'd notice that it was a transistor.
Well, they've said that, haven't they?
Well, that was the thing.
That's
we spoke
why they
to,
took so long.
There's a really, really nice dude at Orange called James, who we speak to every couple of weeks. And he was like, listen, boys, we know. Nobody wants transistor. Everyone wants valve. We know. We get it. Blah, 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 blah. Just give it a go. The reason it's taken us this long is because we wanted to get it right. And they have.
Yeah.
They have. Head is £300. And it's honestly, it sounds great. It sounds absolutely great. If you wanted
you should go over that again. This head is £300.
It's £299.
Let's do a quick spec rundown. So 120 watts.
Yep.
Two channel.
Yeah, you've got two channels. Reverb with three different settings. So you've got spring, hall, and plate, I think, are the three. All of them sound really good. Your drive now, this was yesterday and that feels like last month, but I've got to remember your drive channel. No, your clean channel, you've got a 2-band EQ. Your drive channel, you've got a 3-band EQ. With the drive channel, you've got gain and volume, and then you've also got a master volume as well. And yeah, they do it as a head in orange or black, and they also do a 2x12 combo in orange or black as well. And I was just trying to look up, I can't remember what the speakers are, and I was just trying to figure that out, because that's one of the big things with the orange stuff, especially like their, you know, like the PPC 212. The thing that I love about the PPC 212 is the fact that they've got such good speakers in, because they're Celestion Greenbacks, aren't they?
I think so, in those, and they're just good built. They're all built solid in the UK.
Yeah, that's the key to the sound. Actually, is they use that big marine ply, I think they call it, which is like really chunky. And if you look at an orange cab, it's just bigger.
Yeah.
The 212 is just bigger than any other 212.
Yeah. But it's not heavy. You know, you can get the open back one, which gives you, you know, you don't get quite as much bass response from it than you do with the closed back one. But it's lighter. And, you know, you can easily lift it. Well, I mean, if you're anywhere near as strong and attractive as I am, you can lift it by yourself. This has got all of the... They're not the same speakers. I can't remember what the speakers are in the combo. They're not the same. They're not Celestion Greenbacks. But they sound wicked. They sound really, really, really good. And I had this the head plugged into the orange PPC 412, which does have the Celestions. And they it just sounded absolutely astonishing. And if someone comes in... Because, I mean, the thing is if you want a loud guitar head that... But you don't want to spend a huge amount of money. Kind of your only real option, kind of, was like PV Valve King.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't really think of anything else. If you want something big and drivey and, you know, beefy sounding, I can't really think of anything other than the PV Valve King. You know, the Valve King's a cool head, but, you know, you don't get a huge amount of choice. You know, you want to sit down and you want to try a couple of things. And this easily stands up to the Valve King, despite it being, you know, totally...
Well, I mean,
solid
I did
state.
A video on it, and they just sounded wicked.
Yeah, that video's up on the YouTube channel, actually. Very impressive. I thought it was going to sound much thinner than it does. And
I think that's the big thing.
Thin.
I think that's the thing, is a lot of the... You know, because it's not like a modelling amp. And modelling amps can sometimes sort of lose a little bit in the wash or whatever, but with this, it's just big and boomy, and it sounded great.
It's got balls.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, you can say that.
I think we should leave it at that. Matt Knight, what have you been playing this week?
Well, I was away last week, so I've only been back a few days today. But today, my staff pick came from something I picked up today, which was the, surprisingly for me, the Epiphone ES333 Tom DeLonge.
Well, the reason that you picked this up is I suggested this to you because literally today there's been a huge price reduction on loads of Epiphone stuff.
Mm.
And the one really notable one for me is the Tom DeLonge, which has come down from $349 to 269.
What?
Yes.
Is it that much? 269 they are now.
Alright, I'm buying one. That's done.
Well, I normally wouldn't pick something on staff pick just because we've got a deal on it and go, yeah, we've got a deal on it. I'll play it. But actually, I was like, hold on, I might buy one.
You can buy an awesome matte cappuccino ES333 for less than £300.
Yeah.
It's crazy. 269 is like such an impressive price point for that.
And it's got proper Gibson Dirty Fingers.
I mean, the pickup alone, if you buy that, that must be £100.
I think those pickups, yeah, I mean, they're Gibson make them, so they're like 75 to in between 75 and £100.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, on the podcast, we never like to be kind of too salesy.
Yeah.
Like you say, we try not to mention things that are like, oh, this is on a deal, so go and check this out. But 269. is so cheap for what this is.
Yeah. For such a cool and actually sort of unique guitar. I mean, you've got something that, you know, we all love 335s, but it's kind of got that sort of vibe about it, but it's also just an awesome rock guitar as well.
The thing that I find often lets cheap guitar or cheaper guitars down is the quality of the gloss finish. Mm. Whereas with this, obviously, the matte finish, it doesn't feel like a 250 quid guitar.
No.
It feels like something way more expensive. I mean, it felt really good at 349 quid, but for 269, it's like you might just have that knocking around. I mean, you might not, but I mean, you might be lucky enough to have 269 quid. Be like, oh yeah, I was thinking about maybe getting a guitar. I mean, what else are you going to get for that money? Like, that won't even stretch to a lot of the Squire stuff.
No,
none of the classic vibe stuff. It's a really good point. You know, the classic vibe stuff all kicks in at around sort of 280, 282.
I mean, that's kind of like almost like beginner guitar price.
Yeah.
And you're getting something that is, to be honest,
that between the four of us, we've been playing guitar for 50, 55, 60 years.
Yeah, you know, that's between, about right. Yeah, you know, collectively, yeah.
And we're all going, yeah,
I quite want that.
I quite want one of those. You know, it's not a beginner's guitar by any stretch of the imagination.
So, Matt, just quickly, what's the 333? What does that mean? Obviously, we talk about 335s quite a lot.
I don't know why, actually, I must admit, I don't know why they called it a 333.
I think it was as far as I'm aware, the 333 was an old model, which was the cheaper 335 that instead of being having the wiring done through the front, it had a cutaway, like, it had like a cutout on the back, which I think these have as well, don't they?
No, I think they're all wired in through the body. I think just because it's just done through the one humbucker.
And it's a single pickup as well, which is unique to any of the other
Because I wasn't sure whether before it was just one that...
It was just him going, oh, it's half of 666 or something.
I don't know if there was any real reasoning behind it or not. But yeah, basically, same as the 335 and dot construction, but just the one...
Single pickup.
Dirty
fingers. Great if you're using drive, but also, you know, heard to great effect on the Angels and Airwaves stuff where he's using a cleaner sound. He's still using these guitars. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the Dirty Fingers is the pickup that's in the Gibson 70s tribute Les Pauls and SGs. Yeah,
well, and was also in the Gibson version of these.
The Gibson version of this. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, which is another thing that you just can't get anymore. Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if it's even in the catalogue.
No, the discount. No,
yeah, absolutely great guitar.
But yeah,
absolutely.
I'm thinking about...
We're all going to end up getting one, aren't we? This would be absolutely ridiculous.
I'll play them.
Just called the Tom DeLongers.
I did once see a band who were both guitarists were using the Tom DeLong Strat.
Really?
Yeah, which was quite funny. So.
But it was funny when we talked about it earlier, and I was like, yeah, I'll just get it and change the... Oh, no, wait, hold on.
No, I don't need to change the pickup.
That is a classic thing, isn't it? You, like, when we occasionally get tempted by, like, cheaper guitars or, you know, something that comes in secondhand that is, you know, is not perhaps an American-made guitar, it's always like, oh, yeah, I'll get it and I'll change the pickup because that will make it better. With this, you don't have to do that.
No.
Joe Branton, what have you been playing this week?
Well, this week, basically on my pedal board, I have a Whirlwind Red Box that I'm borrowing from Matt.
Okay, and, which is a compressor.
A compressor, yeah. And Matt needs it back, so. And I've got to go on a tour this week.
Oh dear.
So I've been looking at
Can't
compressors.
You let him have it
through? Oh, he is.
Yeah,
he is.
Hold on. I'm not that bad.
Oh, you're going on a tour, are you?
I can't let any of my precious pedals out on a tour.
I could sell you a compression pedal. That's all Matt's thinking.
I'm more that it freaks you out that your pedals are being used at a gig rather than in your house.
Yeah. Yeah, hold on. They can't go out of the bedroom environment. They don't breathe. They can't survive. It's like you're letting a lizard out of a specially designed tank. we can't let them go out of the bedroom.
So my stuff pick is actually going to be, I'm going to quickly run through three things, because the Whirlwind Redbox compressor I think is absolutely brilliant. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that, but then I'm going to tell you about a couple of alternatives which I also think are very close to that mark With kind of some slight differences. The Whirlwind Redbox, basically MXR, in their original state, the chap who runs Whirlwind designs all of the MXR pedals. When MXR went bankrupt in the 80s, they then started being, the MXR name started being manufactured by Dunlop with the pedals continued, but the chap who actually designed them had already left and gone off to
form Whirlwind.
Who are making, and still do today, make Pro Audio cables. And basically the gist is that he's been under some pressure to reintroduce some of his original designs in Whirlwind, because of course, you know, as MXR have become a massive company, the pedals are, you know, they're not hand built anymore. And you know, maybe, I suppose, well, Whirlwind are arguing that there is a little dip in the quality from what they were when he was making them.
And, you know, people always go on about LEDs being in pedals and how it changed the original circuit and stuff like that. And, you know, now they run on AC power rather than batteries and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, the idea of the Redbox was he was like, for anyone who would want, basically the Redbox is, you know, hence the name, it is the MXR Dynacomp. But the idea was, he was saying, well, this is exactly how I wanted it,
right?
So, and that's what the Redbox is a hand built, really, really awesome version of the MXR Dynacomp for a bit more money. It's £150 for a Whirlwind Redbox, and I think a Dynacomp's coming in at £69.
Yes, but I mean, they do a custom shop Dynacomp, which costs about £200.
Yes, MXR do some. Great additions as well, but I just think, having used a Dynacomp and a Redbox side by side, I think you really do notice a difference, and I'm incredibly impressed with the Redbox. I find it a very useful compressor, but I do think for £69 that the MXR Dynacomp is an incredibly good compressor and one of the best kind of simple compressors on the market to get. And I'd also like to sort of throw in a third one there. MXR also do their Super Comp.
That's the one I really like, I have to admit. I find it a little bit more transparent, I guess.
Yeah.
What I want from a compressor is I don't want to hear that I'm using a compressor.
Right,
and
okay.
For me, I find the Super Comp does that. I mean, I don't know about on guitar, Matt.
I think you're right, because the Dynacomp, you can hear the effect a lot more.
Yeah.
You get a lot more of that kind of classic sort of squash, and the Super Comp tends to be a little bit more transparent.
Oh, I think that's funny that you guys mentioned that, because I like for it to sound like I'm
you
going to
hear a bit
lot
of squish.
Comp. Yeah, exactly. And I like the Super Comp because I found it very similar, but one thing it adds is a gain function on the Super Comp, which just allows me to get a little bit more dirt out of it. I don't use a preamp or anything like a Sans amp on my board or anything like that, where you can get just kind of a little bit of grit to your clean sound. So I rely on my compressor to kind of do that at the end of the chain. And the Super Comp, having that gain function, just allows you to push that compression without kind of sacrificing it a little bit easier than you can with a Redbox or a Dynacomp. And just because those three pedals are so very similar, I kind of wanted to put them together as sort of three different versions of pretty much the same thing, as I think, you know, three of the absolute best simple compressors that you can get on the market, and, you know, ranging from £69 being the cheapest to £149. I don't think they're breaking the bank for very important pedal, certainly for bass players.
Especially for you.
Especially for
just
me.
Get all of them. Knowing your sound, just have three compressors.
Well, this is it. When the Redbox goes back, I'm going to have to get a Super Comp, I guess. Or, you know, I was thinking about the Route 66 compressor.
Oh, by Visual Sounds.
I'm surprised you haven't bought the Philosopher's.
I know, that's the other one, the Philosopher's Tone. Not the bass Philosopher thing, but the Philosopher's Tone, because you got that grip function, and also because Billy Sheehan did a demo with one.
And you have to buy everything that Billy Sheehan has.
That's correct.
Gents, we're running super long, and we've got loads of questions. So shall we do, let's do a load of questions. First up, well, you know, that's how it goes. First up, Ian on Twitter says, I've already got a Les Paul Studio, but looking at buying a PRS Custom SE24. Is it worth it, or are they too similar in tone? Matt Knight.
You know what? I think in terms of playability, they're different. But I think in terms of tone, I think they are fairly similar. If you went up to an American PRS or one of the S2s, which are the new kind of lower range American ones, but for me, I don't think you can beat playing a Les Paul Studio.
A Les Paul Studio, if you want that thick tone, you want like thick mahogany, two humbuckers, then I don't see why you would. Why would you go elsewhere if you've already got a studio?
Yeah, as we've already mentioned earlier, I think studio, traditional Pro 2. We're probably going into a bit more money than an SE24, so we'll just go straight back to an LPJ. We talk about Gibsons a lot, but, they are just awesome.
They've gone through a really good period at the moment of making stuff that's affordable and is kind of true to what you expect from a Les Paul.
Yeah, but, the thing is, POS, especially the SEs, and especially like the new bevel top ones with that kind of the nice flame veneer, they just look a bit nicer.
If what you want is that that like beveled flame top, can't really beat the Custom 24. SE Custom 24.
Yeah. I think that's the thing. I think maybe, like you say, the LPJs are kind of a nicer studio guitar because you probably wouldn't necessarily take them out and be judged by your plain looking Les Paul, whereas if you took out a PRS you'd be like, yeah, this looks a bit cooler.
I would say your other option is if you want something that, if you're really into kind of Les Pauls and you just want something else, look at something with P90s, because that will actually give you a difference in tone. And I'm not sure what they do on the PRS range at the moment. Is there any of the SEs with P90s?
The only one they did for a while, which I can't remember if they still do. They do like a Tremonte, like a cutaway with, I think, a P90.
SE1, which is a single pickup.
I don't think they make that anymore. Used to. The 24s, and they do a 6 and a 7.
Okay. In that case, I guess you'd be looking at the Gibson route. There's Les Paul Juniors available at the moment, is that right?
There's a couple of the old exclusive ones, but there's not much in the catalogue at the moment, actually. It's actually, funny enough, the only one at the moment is the 50s, I think, the Tribute 50s. The P90s is probably the only Les Paul with P90s in, isn't it?
Yeah, you're probably right. So, actually, I would say your options are quite limited because everyone's been focusing on mahogany body, two humbucker guitars around the same price point. I would say if you've got that kind of money to spend, have a look at a Tele. That would be my option. If you want something totally different, have a look at a Tele. Why not? J Cross?
I sort of stayed a little bit away from it because that's...
Because it's obviously what you were going to say.
Well, also, I can also see what the next question that you're going to ask is. And
this feeds perfectly into this. So, Richard on Twitter says, I want a country/rock/folk sound. What guitar is best and what amp should I go with it? J. Cross.
You should buy a Baja Telecaster and a Blues Junior.
Now, first-time listeners of the podcast may not understand Jay's inability to finish that sentence. We recommend every week, don't we? Baja Tele and a Blues Junior. If you want something that does country, rock, folk, for not huge money, the Baja Tele is ideal.
I really think so. If what you want is a Fender sound, I honestly don't think there's a better guitar for less than £1,000 than the Baja Telecaster, which is a real kick in the teeth for me because...
You don't even own one.
Because I've got the American Special, which is quote-unquote the model up. The thing I really like about the Baja is... and this isn't for everyone by any stretch of the imagination. It's got a really, really chunky neck, and that does put some people off. And so if you're not into the chunky neck, then go for the American Special. I love my American Special. I think it's an absolute killer guitar. I really, really do. It's just for me, the chunky neck on the Baja just really adds something. If you want... it kind of depends on... with regards to the amp, it kind of depends on the sort of gigs that you're going to be doing, or, the sort of thing that you're going to be doing. But I think that the Blues Junior is absolutely great. It's great for home use. And you can, if you're in a situation where you're miking up, it's going to be loud enough. If you want something with a little bit more headroom, if you need it to stay really, really clean, and you're playing live, then perhaps the Blues Junior isn't going to be quite big enough.
But then, Hot Rod Deluxe,
Deluxe. Deluxe, depending on what you want. Both of those are 40 watts. The Hot Rod Deluxe has got a really cool drive set. I mean, cool in terms of where you go with Fender built in. It's really, really cool. So,
actually, I'll tell you what I like. Actually, if you want a slightly different alternative to that, maybe you're not bothered about the drive, those new silver-faced 68 Princetons.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we talked about those.
Yeah, we spoke about those last week, man.
Yeah,
you weren't here.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. You know that you listen to the podcast.
I was on holiday, so.
Brilliant. You didn't take your phone on holiday?
No.
I had those as my staff pick last week, the silver-faced Princeton stuff. They won't drive because they're just, I mean, they will drive, but a volume that will probably shake a building to the ground. They're super clean. So you could put a drive pedal in front, maybe a TC Electronic Mojo, which we've talked
really
about before.
I really want a Princeton.
Yeah, I really want one. But yeah, I mean, Blues Junior and a Baja Telly would be our recommendation.
Do you know what? It made me laugh when I was off for a while and I sit at home playing guitar and I was like, hold on, I've got a Blues Junior and I've just bought a vintage blonde Telly. It's like, have I just got Jay's guitar set up? It's like, hold on, this isn't me.
Joe Branton, quick question for you.
Yeah.
This comes from Peter on Twitter, who says, I have a question. What do you think is the best bass overdrive / distortion pedal for under £100?
He pauses.
He's thinking. His Tash is doing like a little
but this, I am thinking, this pedal's not on my notes. So, this pedal? This
one actually came to my personal Twitter.
Oh, right, I see.
And I think forgot to put it on the notes.
No, you did actually tag me in it, and I think I insulted you.
Yeah, that's fairly standard.
For under £100, a bass drive pedal. Obviously,
let
the
me
Big
throw
Muff.
Something into the ring.
Surely this is easy.
Electro-Harmonics bass Big Muff.
There we go. Yeah,
I just said that.
Well, okay.
What do we think? That's the winner. Is that the one to go
well,
for?
Well, no. I was saying that I think that's a really great option. I have one on my board. I think they're brilliant. They're like £50. They are incredibly saturated, and one thing I can't use them for is any stabs, because as soon as you're not playing, it's feeding.
Yeah,
back.
But now there's the bass Big Muff Deluxe, which just come out.
Yeah, which is a great idea. I really like this because I think that bass drives need to have EQ on them in order to make sure that you maintain kind of the clarity.
Because the bass, the Deluxe has got a low and high pass filter, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right,
and
yeah.
And it's got the EQ. Mm.
But it's not under £100.
Oh, is it not?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I just think that the regular bass Big Muff is the one to go for.
Well, there aren't a lot of drives for bass for under £100, which is kind of why I was pausing. I was trying to think of something not as obvious as the Electro Harmonics.
What price point are we looking at now for a Boss ODB3?
£89, I think.
Yeah, you
I
can
mean,
certainly
that's,
consider
that's
those.
Another option.
Flea's still bang into those, isn't there? I've always found them, again, a bit kind of all or nothing.
I find them very...
They're a good, like, second or third stage drive.
Yes,
But if you're looking for a step up from your clean, it's a little bit of a jump. I mean, I think there's some great stuff out there. If you can stretch to sort of £50 more, I think, you know, you've got things like the T-Rex Bass Juice, which I think is an incredible drive pedal. My third stage drive is an Electro Harmonics Microsynth, which isn't a synth. They are drive pedals. They're just called synths. But they're absolutely wicked for kind of a drive pedal with something really different about them. But then you've got, you know, I mean, kind of the best bass drives are things like, I suppose, things like the Polysaturator or...
by Pictronics.
Yeah, exactly. Or... The Master Tron, things
about,
like that.
Did you say maybe a fat drive, something like that?
Yeah, maybe. I mean,
fat drive. They've introduced a bass fat drive. Again, it's over £100. But the fat drive, it actually works perfectly well on bass. I've
again,
found.
Another Pictronics pedal that we all really rave about. But yeah, again, it pushes you over that £100 mark. If you're looking for something that is just not super expensive, will do you a really, really good job of doing a really saturated drive, and you can wind it back a little bit, then it's, you know, it's got to be the Electro-Harmonics bass Big Muff. It's got to be the one.
Yeah.
One more question. This comes in from Kev via email. I promised last week that we'd answer his question, and we've actually got round to doing some research, and we now have an answer, I believe, Matt. Kev says... Not sure whether you're still doing the how to sound like topics on the podcast, but I'd love to know your opinion on how to achieve Neil Young's electric tone, particularly the tone on the Weld album. Neil uses some weird and very unique gear, so it'd be great to get some advice on how to achieve this tone with off-the-shelf gear. Matt Knight, I tasked you with researching this. Any joy?
Yes. I mean, I'm not... I do like Neil Young, and I can, you know, I've listened to a fair bit. I couldn't go into the specific album because I couldn't listen to the whole thing and think, oh, that's that and that. But I thought I'd do some research into, because I've known for a long time the guy who used to work here is a massive fan, and he actually, I think his setup in a sense is actually fairly standard in the fact that he uses a guitar plugged into an old Fender tweed amp, like a Bandmaster or a 57 Deluxe or 57 Twin. I think the key to his tone, essentially, obviously he uses a 56 Les Paul Gold Top,
which
has been totally stripped and painted black, which has then had a P90 in the neck and a Firebird pickup fitted to the bridge.
That sounds glorious.
Yes, with a Bigsby. So I think if you're going for the guitar, go for something 50 style, so go something P90, so 50s Les Paul. But the real key, I think, is actually the fact that he uses something like 57 Deluxe, which they're only 19, they're usually between 12 and 19 watts. And
depending on which, what you're talking, you know, if you look at things like the Clapton one, is a different spec to more recent reissues.
And it's basically turned up really, really loud. It's turned up to full. Which brings me on to this cool bit of gear that I thought we could talk about, the Whizzer, which we've been discussing similar ideas for the last few weeks before podcast. It's something that sits on top of the amp, then directly plugs onto the volume and two tone controls, and then has three preset settings and then a floor pedal that when he clicks it, physically sends information to the Whizzer that then mechanically turns
like this pedal that we were talking about, but
somehow this foot pedal sends a signal and then goes between three predetermined pot settings on the amp to then go between clean, slightly distorted and very distorted.
Right, and so when it's on, physically just turning the controls
physically
on the
turning
amp.
The amp up and down. So the cheapest way you could do that would be have the amp on full and then use a volume pedal would probably be. You don't get the same sort of thing because you're not physically winding the power amp up and down, but as I was just reading earlier, when he's running it on full, because those amps are so little, it runs so hot they have two full size fans at the back to cool it down. To stop it from blowing
so
up.
Stage fans, almost the kind of Mariah Carey blowing hair in the wind video fans on the back of his amp.
And funny enough, he was quoted about 10 years ago in an interview talking about guitar rigs that he actually owns apparently 400 different types of Fender tweed amps from around those points, but only one, which is the main one he used, sounds the way he wants it to sound.
Whoa.
But it leads me on to...
So that basically means... You will never get this out.
If Neil Young has got, you know, basically an infinite budget to spend on this, and he's got 399 that haven't worked out and one that has worked out, getting exactly his sound is going to prove quite difficult, I would imagine.
But, so, basically, that allows him to use the natural distortion that comes from an amp and forego any sort of gain boost or distortion pedal. So, the closest thing you could go for would be... for like a tweedy sounding guitar pedal, I'm trying to think what would be most like more of an amp drive. So they say like the Hot Tubes, like we were saying, the Electro-Monix did the first amp style distortion. It'd probably be something like that.
Yeah, brand new product. I've not even heard the Hot Tubes yet, but I mean, I guess that...
It's got more of that, as we've said a lot, that raucous, rough around the edges drive sound. It's not like a Boss OD3 or, you know, it's a very tight... overdrive sound like a tube screw or something. It's a bit more rough around the edges, but he also uses, because I thought you know you boys would enjoy this, he used an amp called the Baldwin Exterminator, which had two 8-inch, two 15-inch and two 12-inch speakers in
yes.
it.
Yes.
I don't know,
and it was totally solid state and had the same germanium transistors that they put in a lot of the early 60s fuzz pedals and then just had four buttons on it.
Amazing.
Brilliant.
And he also used another amp that then fed into a 2000 watt PA system, which he uses on stage just for on stage use. And then a Magnatone 280. And you mentioned Magnatones in a little tweet to me earlier. And this was a stereo Leslie style vibrato amp that had two speakers, but two amps that went to fed to two individual speakers. So two vibratos for each speaker. So crazy bonkers. Old gear.
So the answer is, Kev, you're probably not going to get it spot on, but like we said, Les Paul with P90s and something Fendery, and if you can find a way to drive the front end like the Hot Tubes, or, I mean, is there any sort of attenuator that could go between?
I would, if it was me and you were going to do it and there was no sort of real budget, I would do like a 50s Les Paul, like a custom shop one, into a Clapton EC Vibrachamp, so you've got some vibe sounds and some drive sounds. And just turn it up
as loud as your neighbours.
If you're going to do it on a quarter, get a half decent overdrive pedal, something like the EHX Hot Tubes, into a 50s tribute with P90s, and go into something like probably like a Blues Junior.
Very good. Kev, I hope that's answered your question. You also said something about setting up a PA. I think we're going to save that for a future podcast. Next week or the week after, we'll talk about the kind of PA that you would want for a small gigging band, I guess, and we'll have some stuff laid out. If you've got any questions that you want us to answer on the podcast, always send them over, podcast@gak.co.uk. You can also send them in via Twitter, which is @gak_co_UK, or on Facebook, facebook.com/gakmusic. Or you can get in touch with us individually. If you want to get in touch with me, Twitter is the best way, @mark_random. Jay Cross, how can people get in touch with you?
If you want to get in touch, you can shoot me an email at j.cross@gak.co.uk or talk to me on Twitter, jaybm1.
Joe Branton, how can people get in touch?
If you want to shoot me an email, you can get hold of me at joe.branton@gak.co.uk, or if you want to speak to me on Twitter, my Twitter handle is @Yosef_900.
Matt Knight, how can people get in touch with you, and what do you want to talk about this week?
People can email me at matt.knight@gak.co.uk, or you can tweet me at @matt_knight, that's Knight with S-I-E in the end.
You said that faster than a human can hear.
Sorry. It's Knight with S-I-E on the end.
So matt_knight.
And if you want to talk to me, you can tweet me about the... I'm talking about gut shots of pedals. I've got one guy sending me some... Literally the...
Sorry?
The, like...
Gut
like,
shots.
Yeah, so take the back off and send me pictures of the circuit boards.
Is that an official term?
Pedals. That is, actually.
Really? The gut shots?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Well, you know, like, shot, photograph. I don't know.
Someday
maybe
soon,
it's an American thing.
You're going to get arrested.
I think we should end it there, gentlemen. Thanks for listening this week. Pop back next week. We're going to be talking about the Fender Custom Shop night that we're doing... tomorrow night in store, that will have already happened by the time you hear this. We'll talk
it's
about
like time travel or something.
We'll also be talking about our Gear of the Year podcast, which is something we're going to be announcing next week. And Matt Knight can talk about some gut shots.
Yes.
Thanks for listening. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. Welcome to the GAK.co.uk Guitar Shop Podcast.
Put your hands in the air!
Woo! Hey,
I'll make that mic.